Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us for our Friday show with Lane County Senior Public Health Officer, Dr. Patrick Ludke. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald, and Dr. Ludke is here in the studio. Thanks for being here.
Happy to be here again. Thank you.
So we asked our listeners to leave voicemails and send us emails with their questions. We may not be able to get to all of them, but first, as we just heard, the latest numbers for Oregon for COVID-19, the Oregon Health Authority announced 600 new confirmed and presumptive cases. That's the highest daily case count for the state since the pandemic started. And we're talking a little bit about testing today, also contact tracing and vaccines. Most of our questions were about testing. And just to start with, back in the spring, you know, it was really difficult to get tested for COVID-19. Has that changed? And can you explain the kinds of tests available and how reliable they are?
I'm happy to do so. It has indeed changed. We're very fortunate, especially in Lane County, that we have a good deal of testing resources locally. So early on, back in February, there really was only one test available. It was a PCR test, and our 50 state laboratories did that test for the country. And of course, it wasn't enough as the virus numbers increased. And then industry began making other types of virus tests. So the antigen tests, the antibody tests, and some research laboratories started to do sequencing of the genome, or in this case we call it the virome because it's a virus. So really there's those four main categories. There's these molecular tests like PCR. There are antigen tests that actually look for pieces of the viral proteins, most typically. There's antibody tests that look for pieces of what your body makes in response to an infection, so our antibodies. And then there are these whole genome sequencing and other types of sequencing tests that are out there. But the big two, really, that are used mostly in clinical practice are the molecular tests and the antigen tests. And again, we're lucky that we've had several entities in our county that have stepped up and allow us to do local testing. A fair number of counties in Oregon, of our 36 counties, they don't have that option, and they're sending tests out, and the turnaround time gets to be pretty long, and it's a challenge. So I hope I answered that question, Rachel.
Well, how easy is it for someone to get a test right now?
Well, for most people, it's relatively easy, certainly way easier than February, March, April, as we started the pandemic. But that doesn't mean it's easy for everyone. Some people struggle to get into a clinic. They maybe don't have a car, or they don't have access to mass transit. So they will still have the same challenges trying to get a COVID test. But we do have these four sites that are doing testing in high volume now, the Peace Health Hospital System, the McKenzie Hospital System, a urgent care group, Nova Health, and then the university has stepped up and they brought on testing on their campus footprint as well. So a good deal of testing is taking place. And then this last week, which is new since we last spoke, you probably have heard about this test called the Binax Now. Our federal government has sunk a few hundred million dollars into getting 150 million of these tests. Lane County received those tests this past week, and we have begun sending them out to clinics that are interested in this rapid antigen test that gives a result in 15 minutes. We have now 21 clinics as of, I believe, yesterday. Might be this morning, actually. Time goes so fast. 21 clinics that have signed up to get that rapid antigen test from us. So I would suggest to your listeners that there will be even more testing access in the days to come.
We had some questions about the accuracy of testing. This one is from Dana via email. Last week, 5 U of O football players tested positive for COVID. After retesting, they were all determined to be false positives. And she points out that's 5 out of 5 errors. And how can we trust any test results?
I think it's a good question. Anytime we have a new agent out there, whether it's a coronavirus or something like SARS or MERS, or if some of your listeners might remember monkeypox, you know, 15 years ago, an interesting virus that came to North America, we should be really vigilant with our testing to interpret the results. What I can say is we really need to divide, I think, the assessment of test results into two main categories. People who are symptomatic And if they are symptomatic with COVID-compatible symptoms, you know, they have a cough, they have a fever, they have shortness of breath, they have a pretest probability that's markedly higher. And that phrase, pretest probability, probably doesn't mean much to many listeners, but it's a statistical assessment of what a positive means if someone has symptoms or doesn't. So let's break off one group of people and say you're symptomatic, and those symptoms are compatible with a COVID diagnosis. If you get a positive on a test, it's much more likely to be a true positive. Now, there is asymptomatic screening, and we just don't have good data in those populations. So if someone is asymptomatic, they have no respiratory symptoms whatsoever, but they're being screened because they want to go see grandma, let's say, or grandpa, somebody who is presumably in an older age group and perhaps at higher risk, determining what that test means is much harder. And we just have not done enough studies to really understand how to interpret asymptomatic screening tests. So we in public health are saying, gosh, try to focus all of our testing at present on the symptomatic group of people. And this new test that I mentioned that we're sending out to these 21 clinics so far is for symptomatic people. Sorry, long answer.
Well, this one kind of goes to that question about symptoms. This is from Christopher, who emailed us and says, as we entered the fall season, I began to have a cough and a bit of a runny nose. I'm 68, and normally I wouldn't worry about these symptoms, particularly since I usually have allergies. But with COVID-19 out there, I'm wondering if I should find a testing option. And then he says, it just makes me stressed. I understand that.
I do too, actually. I'm not in the highest of risk groups, but I'm in my 60s, and that puts me, you know, at higher risk than if I was 25 years old. And I too wonder, when I get my first sniffles of the year, is it going to be influenza or just the common cold? And of course, the vast majority of the time, it's not going to be COVID. It's going to be one of these other agents. But if you have exposure to someone who has a confirmed case, and you were not protected, let's just say that you forgot a mask that day, or some other way you were potentially exposed, well, that clearly raises that phrase again, I'm going to say, pretest probability. So if you have unusual, more severe than normal respiratory symptoms, well, I would suggest most anybody should go be evaluated, whether it's by your primary care provider or going to urgent care or an ED. But if it's mild, again, 80% of COVID infections in people will be either asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic, like the common cold. No reason to rush off to be tested for symptoms like that.
Okay. Well, here's a question from Kathleen, who emailed us and said, my 20-year-old granddaughter tested positive for COVID 52 days before her second doctor's appointment. She went back to the doctor due to a lingering cough and other symptoms. She tested positive again. So the question is, was she positive for the entire 52 days?
Yeah, this is a challenging area. So it's possible that she either had viral products present for many weeks, and that next test, the second test, was picking up the past infection, and we absolutely have seen that. We have seen people who have had positive, especially these molecular tests, these highly sensitive molecular tests, they have been positive for weeks and weeks and weeks after a single infection. So I would need to know what kind of test she had. Was it an antigen test or a molecular test? Was it testing actual proteins of the virus, or was it testing the genetic material of the virus? Those are two different things. And then also, I would want to know a bit perhaps about the clinical history of this person. So for example, someone who's immunocompromised, their immune system isn't working well. So if they have say leukemia, if they have someone else's kidney inside of them and they're on anti-rejection drugs that make their immune system less effective, then that can really play with interpreting laboratory test results too. But in general, the tests that we have now are really quite good. They're not perfect. They're far from perfect. But they are really quite good, and they're especially good in those persons who have symptoms that are compatible with COVID.
And certainly we've heard about folks who've had, you know, have what they're calling the long haul cases, and it sounds like this might be one of those.
Yeah, it's certainly possible that it is. And again, if it was a PCR test, it would be more likely that it would be one of those persistent positives. But a fair number of people who get a PCR and they have a positive COVID case, their PCR 2 weeks later is negative. So these are not the norms where people stay positive for a long time. It's just that some people, for whatever reason, they don't clear those leftover viral fragments as quickly as others, and they have a positive test for weeks.
We had this question from Robin via email, who wanted to know about who is eligible to receive testing for COVID-19. For example, if I'm arriving to visit elderly parents after traveling by plane from another state, could I get a test? Or vice versa, if I'm returning from such a trip in order to avoid quarantine, could I get tested?
Yeah, in general, we recommend against that type of asymptomatic testing. There are a few areas where asymptomatic screening is happening. So, for example, in long-term care facilities that have a really high-risk population, you know, a large number of people in their 70s, 80s, 90s who already have health issues, we really don't want to have an outbreak get out of control there. And we want to find the very first or second case before it becomes 30, 40, 50. So we are, in fact, doing asymptomatic screening there. But in general, in the general public, asymptomatic screening, we just don't have the data to recommend it in most people. And we realize that, of course, there are situations where people need it. There are situations where people think they need it and they really don't, but there are situations where they do. So perhaps a hospital mandates that before you come in for an elective surgery, you have to prove that you're COVID negative and that requires a test. There's a few states, I understand Hawaii still has testing and Alaska may have testing requirements. Before you travel here, you have to have a negative test within such and such a time. Well, we recognize those happen. But in general, asymptomatic people who are just going to go visit someone do not benefit that much from a test because the tests are not perfect.
We did get a question regarding employees of hospitals and nursing homes, whether, you know, what kind of testing regimen makes sense for hospital and nursing home employees. And I guess this person says they are a caregiver at a local hospital and have not been tested, but they've heard of nursing homes testing on a regular basis.
Yes, they have indeed been testing on a regular basis. Our governor had a mandate for nursing homes to test all of their employees by September 30th at least once, and then have a testing program going forward to make sure that, again, we pick up that first case before it becomes a huge wildfire type of outbreak, which is bad enough in any population, but of course it's significantly worse in a high-risk population like an older nursing home population. So I think that we still don't have all the science we'd like to have in terms of asymptomatic screening. I suspect many of your listeners are aware of what's happened in professional sports recently. I mean, we just had the World Series, and of course, Major League Baseball had screening of all their athletes. And a week ago was the NBA Finals, and there was screening in the NBA and screening in the NFL. And the airline industry, select airlines have had screening of their employees. So it is a work in progress. We don't fully understand the use, again, of these tests in these asymptomatic populations, but we've identified some high-risk sites, like long-term care facilities, like some meatpacking plants where people are literally shoulder to shoulder in some heavy work where they're breathing heavy because they're chopping, etc. And we really need to make sure those places are safe. So I could talk about this for a long time. We could do a whole show on testing. But suffice it to say, asymptomatic testing in most people who are just at home and not in a high-risk work site is of little benefit.
All right. Well, we'll talk. I'm sure we'll get to talk more about testing. Ahead, we'll talk a little bit about contact tracing and the vaccine. But right now, we'll just take a quick break.
This Week in This American Life. With gun sales up in these unsettling times, we ask all kinds of people, why'd you buy your first gun now?
I actually went and looked at guns at one gun shop on the Thursday after the debate, and they were out.
They're white liberals like that guy, people of color.
There's a lot of fear. You got the extremists, and you don't know who they are.
That's this week.
This American Life, Saturday at noon on KLCC.
Support for KLCC comes from Bose Wine Depot. Bose Wine Depot offers wine delivery and a safe walk-in shopping experience at their Eugene and Springfield stores. Locations, hours, and online ordering at BoseDepot.com.
I'm Rachel McDonald. You're listening to KLCC's Friday show with Lane County's public health doctor, Patrick Ludke. We got a voicemail question about contact tracing, and I'm sure this is something a lot of people want to know.
Hello, this is Dorothy in Eugene with a question about contact tracing. How will I know it's them when they call? There are so many scams and phishing calls. I don't pick up my phone if I don't know who it is. So will they leave me a message so I can call them back? I do want to talk to them, but I want to know that it's really them and not some scammer. Okay, thanks. Bye.
So how do we know?
Well, I think it's a good question, and I'm actually with that caller where I look at my phone. If it says no caller ID, I just don't answer it. I get enough calls each day, and I don't want to spend my time on someone I don't know who it is or I'm not expecting. So, yes, Lane County Public Health will identify itself, absolutely. We will leave a message letting you know who we are, and we'll leave you a callback number. And I really thank the fact that she is interested in being part of the solution. And it's not just for her health and her family's health, but we as a community are required to comply with various metrics in order to remain open, so to speak. You know, we're in phase two of the governor's reopening. And if we're unable to link a case to existing cases, we call those sporadic cases. And as that sporadic case number increases, we are not meeting some of the metrics, and we may have to go back to phase one and close more facilities or have smaller gatherings. And we don't want to be there. So we really want people to answer our phone call. And we did discuss in the last week about how can we make sure people know that this is really public health calling. It's not a scammer. And we're trying to figure out better ways to do that. And there probably will be more to talk about that in the days to come to make sure that we're meeting the needs of the community in that regard.
I know I've seen that one piece of advice is to call back Lane County Public Health if you do get a call and you're a little concerned, and ask them if they, you know, if you really did get a call from a contact tracer.
And indeed, they can do that. And we have a regular line for our communicable disease team, a phone number, and then we have a extended call service that we're using too. So yes, if you're ever concerned, you can certainly go to our website and call one of our numbers, our 1380 number, 541-682-1380, or our regular disease reporting number, which is 541-682-4041. That's the normal number we've had for years before COVID came and we needed an alternate line.
And so, you know, you kind of explained why contact tracers are needed. We had a question via email about whether there's still a need for more contact tracers. This is someone who said they'd like to be one, but they weren't sure if there was still a need.
So there is, right now we're meeting the need, but people don't always stay in their part-time employment or their volunteer status, and people rotate on and off. So if you're interested, absolutely contact Lane County Public Health, and we can get you on the list. And as people rotate on and off, as things happen that we maybe need more people, like a huge outbreak, you will be on the list, and we will contact you in order.
And for people that maybe they're not so worried that it's a scam, but maybe they're worried that somehow there will be some sort of, you know, they'll be identified as having COVID-19 if they respond to a contact tracer. Is that the case? Or, I mean, is there any concern that people could be sort of outed and that would destroy their reputation?
So, well, we don't share this data beyond the health department, if that was your question, Rachel.
Mm-hmm.
This is privileged information, and there's an amazing amount of privilege, actually, where even if there are so-called subpoenas and, you know, needs to know, it's de-identified data, and it's really well protected. I feel that, you know, it's not my decision, it's the Attorney General's office decision how this works, and I think Oregon has a really good protective system, and I've practiced public health in quite a few states. It's robust here.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about vaccine questions. We didn't get a whole lot of questions from the public about vaccines, but I had my own question. Just how will having a vaccine change things? And will we still need to wear masks once there is a vaccine?
I can always expect the tough questions here. I'm going to buff my crystal ball and give you a sense here. So A part of the answer depends upon how many people get the vaccine. The goal, the way to break the back of a pandemic, is to get immunity. And there are two main ways to get it. You can either get the infection and develop antibodies on your own, or we can give you a vaccine that has those chemicals in it that stimulate immunity, and then your body makes antibodies. So those are the two main ways. Of course, there's other ways. You could have antibodies and you could infuse them in your bloodstream. We do that for some people who are immunocompromised. We don't have bags of these antibodies sitting around yet, so that's not a solution for 340 million Americans. But if we get enough people to get immunity one way or another, we'll break the back of this pandemic, and it will break slowly. We're not going to have a light switch, and the next day we're going to say everybody go back and have fun like the old days. It will be a devolution from a pandemic, which is epidemics everywhere, to regional epidemics and then just local epidemics in a few places. And that's how it's going to go away. And your question about will we wear masks, we've been talking about that for some time since we saw so many companies step up to make vaccines. And most likely, people will continue to need to wear masks until we really have a better sense of how good is this vaccine and how much community immunity is there. And we're not going to know that for some time. So people are going to be needing to wear masks for their own health and the health of their community, certainly for months to come.
And can you touch a little bit on who might be kind of first in line to get a vaccine once it's approved and we know it's safe? And it starts to be distributed?
Sure, I'm happy to do so. And, you know, we're leaning on our past experiences. So the most recent, of course, was the H1N1 pandemic in 2009, 2010. And we had testing issues then, just like we do now with COVID. We had vaccine issues then, just like we have now. And we worked on priority groups. So that prioritization process has been, you know, fairly well traveled in the last couple decades. And the process we're using now, promulgated out by the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, looks at four main priority groups for COVID vaccine. And I don't think they'll be a surprise to anyone listening today. The first priority group is really, they're calling it phase one, and it's high-risk healthcare workers and first responders. And they will get the vaccine first. So as that trickle of vaccine starts to come in, you know, at the end of the year and early next year, those will be the first groups. The second group will be other critical workers, and we'll include teachers and school staff in that list, as well as other people with these comorbid, really tough underlying conditions that place them at high risk. And there are a few other people listed in that group, but those are the big ones in phase two. And come phase three, which will probably be in the second quarter, April, May, June of next year, is when we start to get students, kids, young kids and adolescents into the group. And then finally, phase four is everybody else. So we do have a prioritized protocol from the Center for Disease Control, and that's what the states will be looking at once the vaccines start to trickle in.
Okay. We're going to switch gears real quick and go on to, we had more questions about Thanksgiving, and we just have a little bit of time, but I think we can cover this one from Marilyn.
Hi, this is Marilyn calling from Independence, Oregon. My question is, my husband and I are both in our 70s. We have not seen our son in a very long time, and we are having him come to our home on Thanksgiving. When he is at our home, do we keep masks on the whole time when we're in the house together? I know we won't always be 6 feet apart. Anyway, any information, any other safety precautions we could take during this visit would be appreciated. Thank you.
So you have 30 seconds for this answer.
So I will prioritize very quickly then. So first, it would be very nice if this visiting child, adult child, would quarantine himself for as long as possible before the visit. And in that way, he will not become infected with something that perhaps he would spread. Number two, upon arrival, I think that he should be masked as long as possible. And certainly during those times when there are potential exposures, try to decrease those exposures and wear a mask when you can. But after a period of time, and I don't know how long this person is going to stay there, the risk goes back to the risk is in the household, right? He didn't bring COVID with him. So if he's going to stay for a month, well, you know, after 10 to 14 days, the risk is almost zero, and then you become a household unit, and you don't have to go ahead and wear a mask when you're in the home.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Dr. Ludke, and thanks for joining us for our Friday show, where we had production assistance from Angela Kellner, Mallory Begay, and Jason Brown. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald.